Coming up next, Writing on the Air. This portion of Writing on the Air is underwritten in part by Austin Partners in Education, a nonprofit organization looking for volunteers to assist Austin ISD students and become a part of connecting the community and the classroom. With just an hour each week, community members can strengthen our schools, support our teachers, and make a difference in the lives of our students. For more information, you may visit austinpartners.org. Or call 512-637-0988. Well, good evening. This is Writing on the Air, and this is Dylan McKenzie Engineering tonight. Lee Davis is hosting a theatrical panel this evening. Dora is in the house after a long battle with the flu.
And please get your
flu shots.
Is that a shot of what? What was your favorite shot?
The hot toddies.
Uh-huh.
After I could breathe, but it really is nasty stuff. So I'm knocked me out for about 4 days of work and took me a couple of weeks. So it's kind of not fun stuff.
Well, it's good to have you back.
We missed you.
Did you get a chance while you were ill to listen in at all?
I did, and also actually got a chance to do a little bit of writing because. You know, started getting pretty bored just, you know, staying in the bed. So that was the only kind of the gift of the flu was some time writing.
Well, I didn't have the flu, but my affliction was almost as bad because I'm in the middle of a move. And so that hasn't been a whole lot of fun.
Oh, you're doing the boxes.
The box thing, yeah. But it's, you know, it's fun to contemplate getting into a new place, but it's certainly not fun making it happen.
Well, and as I understand it, Dylan, you're even going to have your own kind of mini studio there.
Yes.
I mean, room for all of your equipment.
Yes, I will. And in terms of writing, you know, during this whole chaotic time, as you know and some of our listeners know, I also edit a journal of poetry called Ardent. And so the next issue is coming out very shortly, and I had to finish editing that, which was rather difficult this time in terms of trying to keep my head in the right place and still have all this chaos around me.
And not packing the galleys in a box and going, oh gosh, where's the galley?
So. Well, I only have one computer that's survived so far, and I'm used to having three, so I bounce things back and forth from computer to computer, so that was another handicap. Well, our guests today are in the house and prepared to bring you some theatrics. Lee is here, and we're going to put him on the microphone in just a moment. He's busy cleaning house.
He's fluffing up his new beard.
Yeah.
Lee, little touch of gray there on,
we
the, on
have
the bottom.
We have a headphone challenge, but we have now got everyone headphoned in. It's exciting. It's a good feeling.
So, Lee, what's been going on with you?
Dusting.
Dusting.
You know, exciting. Writing, reminiscing, reflecting on the better things in life.
He did come up and help me move some stuff. That was amazing.
That's right.
Last weekend, we moved two truckloads of stuff.
It was. Thank God for a hydraulic lift gate.
Yeah.
It was good. This guy's got some stuff. You know, there's people, there's help for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's the comedian talks about his stuff? Oh, Carlin, George Carlin.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I got to get rid of some stuff.
Exactly. I was quite amazed with all the stuff that you have organized in the boxes and trays and various things and pens and paper. Amazing, amazing. And then
there's a name for that disorder in the DSM.
We weren't going to go there. But anyway, so if you hadn't had any time to write then recently in the last few days then?
Not write, just edit.
And that's editing stuff, as in your
physical... Yeah, editing the journal.
Exactly. Okay, well that is quite neat. Well, it's good to have you back, and glad, Dora. I'm very quite happy to see you back.
Oh, nice to be back.
And we have a great and full studio. It's nice to see your shining faces. And we have some other lovely faces in the studio with us today. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Mr. Anton Deether, and we have some other special guests, Miss Diane, Miss Jennifer, Miss Larry, and we're going to be going over a wonderful piece called Suburban Gothic. Anton, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Lee?
Great, Anton. It's great to have you back. I think we had you on in, I think it was December of 2007, and so it's been a while, but we're glad to have you back. It was a different studio then. It was pre-fire, or pre-third fire.
That's right.
But it's great to have you back.
During the Writers Guild strikes. So that was quite a few years ago.
Oh, that's right. Right. Oh, my goodness. So we want you to set us up with this story, and then we're going to jump into it, because we have a real treat for our listeners today. We're going to be doing a table read, if you will, of a couple of different wonderful sections of this piece, Suburban Gothic, which was inspired by a wonderful piece from the 1800s. And,
19th century.
19th century, excuse me. Well, 1800s.
It's Henry James, Turn of the Screw, mm-hmm. a classic novella that a lot of people know about.
Mm-hmm. And would you set us up, sir?
All right. Well, it's a contemporized version of an old Victorian classic set in suburbia. And if anyone knows the original story, which involves a headmistress or a nanny who is hired to take on two children who are seem very troubled, very strange, sharing a lot of secrets. And it turns out that, or at least in her eyes, that they're haunted by the ghosts of two servants who had died violently in the past. And taking that same premise and updating it to suburbia, the main character, Julie, who's also herself very troubled, she's a prescription addict. She has no children of her own, but she is a professional nanny, and she is hired to take care of these two kids over the summer, alone in a house where their mother had died. Well, actually, her mother died in a car accident close by the year before, and like the original Henry James version, we're not sure if she's imagining that they are haunted or possessed by the ghost of their mother, and which is something that's revealed late in the story, a neighbor who she's having a very sordid affair with, that the children are very much aware of, and they've been traumatized by it, which culminated in their mother's death. That's the backstory. So basically, it's really about how this woman tries to cope with the situation and also redeem her past, because as a child she lost her little brother drowning in a pool. She was looking after her brother, and that changed her whole life and made it difficult for relationships, everything. So that's a part of the scenes that we'll be reading. Just so you all know the names, the two children's names are Sean and Melissa. Julie is their nanny. In later scenes, there is a best friend named Terry who will appear. The off-screen characters are, the dead character is Max, who is the neighbor from the past. The little boy who drowned in her own childhood past, his name is Billy. It just helps to know when reading these scenes who these names are. Okay?
So, without any further ado, let's do the reading. And this is the excerpt from Suburban Gothic. Exterior, pool area day. Clad in a bikini, Julie repots her plants in the hot sun. A pizza box sits on a patio table. She glances at the pool, cool and inviting. A screechy caw, caw distracts her. Black crows squabble over the overhanging branches of the next door pomegranate tree. They pick at fruit with their beaks. Blood-red juice seeps down the fence wall. Julie powers on the hose and sprays them away. Pool shallow in, later. Julie steps onto the pool steps for a swim. She squints at the sun-speckled water. Its sequins seem to brighten unnaturally. She loses her nerve, then sees Sean staring from the kitchen doorway, Melissa beside him.
Well, howdy. It's about time.
She goes to the patio table and opens the pizza box.
Half extra cheese, half pepperoni.
They step outside and approach the table. Melissa nibbles on a pizza, gazing surreptitiously at the pool.
Hot outside. Want to go for a swim?
You can't swim after you eat.
Yeah, kids die in pools.
You can always play in the shallow side with adult supervision.
Where are we going to find an adult?
My God, a joke.
It's not safe.
Are you scared of your own pool?
We don't like it much.
How come?
Freddie.
Melissa darts him a warning look. Their eyes lower to grinning scuba diver on the pool's bottom. Julie looks down.
Freddie? That down there? Come on, guys. That's paint on cement.
I'm not a guy, okay? I'm going back inside.
Oh, come on.
I don't see you going in the pool.
Julie sighs and beelines to the deep side. She stares down, hesitating. Turns aside to the kids.
Well, you coming in or not?
You first.
A challenging look. Julie faces the pool, teeters on the edge, then swan dives in. Splash! A swell of water. Sean and Melissa stare down with widened eyes. Underwater, a green, unfocused world. Julie swims over the painted figures of the scuba diver and the happy octopus. Julie surfaces and clutches the poolside, looking around. The kids are gone. The treehouse's rope ladder dangles wildly. She looks up. The kids watch her from a high perch on the tree platform, Melissa with her camcorder. Treehouse. Melissa's camcorder point of view, focusing down on Julie in the pool.
Bianca, trapped in the danger zone.
Hey there. Can I come up too?
No adults.
He frantically hoists up the ladder. Exterior, pool area, day. Dismissing him, Julie starts to dive back down, then stops herself. That old childhood fear, mustering her courage, Julie sucks in breath and plunges down. Underwater, swimming to the bottom, Julie's point of view turns on the scuba diver, a chlorine-eaten face, wide, paint-etched eyes, his open mouth grins with cartoonish glee. Her point of view scans across the bottom. Settled leaves, tree seeds, dead spiders, dead June bugs, dead bees, and little Billy's drowned corpse. A bubbled gasp. Exterior treehouse day, through camcorder, Julie explodes to the surface and frantically power strokes to the shallows. She sits on the pool steps, shivering from shock.
Something's wrong.
She shouldn't go in that pool.
All right. Ooh, dog, anybody else sweat besides me? Great read. I really, wow. So, was it what you thought it would be? Tell me about that.
That's about 20 minutes into the film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's been hired by their father, who's going out of town on business, and she's alone in the house. These two kids are, like, very strange. They're like night crawlers. They just don't come out. And she's trying to be friends with them and trying to, you know, orientate herself to them. And she's had a very hard time. And this is really the scene, the first time they've actually even communicated with each other. So mm-hmm. That's where we're at that point. And then she's going to win them over, and they start to have a relationship, and they start to bond.
Right. So did a lot of this, I'm just curious to know, did it come to you this natural, in this form, and were you able to pull and automatically see the symbolism of in the turning of the screw?
Well, even though I had started with the idea of adapting a novel, this was written some years ago during a very dark time in my life. I had a very bad marriage with children and, on the brink of divorce. And I was home alone for a month, for actually a whole summer. The family went to Russia, and I was alone in this house with the pool. My house at that time was exact same as the pool in this story.
Really?
So I was kind of home alone at night with the pool lights on, and I just started thinking, and fantasizing dark things. Because I was in the mood.
Were you drinking vodka? Just for the Russian
yes.
compliment? Okay, very
Russian
neat.
Vodka.
Exactly. Anton Deether is here today with his business partner, Diane, from Deontan Productions, and we're reading Suburban Gothic. We will be right back in just a few minutes after we hear from our underwriters. We thank you for tuning in. You're listening to Writing on the Air. Stay tuned.
Attention, photographers! Co-op wants your pictures of Austin to include in our 2010 calendar. Submit your high-res images to calendar@coop.org, and it may be selected to appear in the first-ever Co-op calendar. All listeners and members are invited to participate. Send your photos in to calendar@coop.org today.
This portion of KOOP programming is supported in part by the Texas Observer, an independent news magazine writing about issues that are sometimes ignored or underrepresented in the mainstream media. The Texas Observer promotes democratic participation and open government. For more information on subscriptions, you may call 477-0746 or you may visit texasobserver.org.
You're listening to KOOP Hornsby Austin, 91.7 on the FM dial. And this is Writing on the Air.
Anne, thank you so much. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here with you and our fascinating entourage this day. We have Diane Bernard and Anton Deether from Dianton Productions here with us today. Diane, it is good to see you, and thank you for the last name for clarification. It's a pleasure. We have a full house in studio. Let's see, it's six or seven people. All the microphones and extra cans are actually out. So, Anton, tell us about this firm, Dianton.
I think I'll let Diane talk about that, because she's the business part.
Okay.
Yeah, but we've got Anton, who is the creative writer, and he does all the stamping on all the productions that we go on, because he's got a great eye and a talent for the written word, and so, you know, I give him all the kudos for that. On my side, I handle a lot of the business parts of it. We are in production with a number of films. We raise capital and investments. We manage getting optioned in new talent. We've got, I don't know, can we announce what a recent thing that we've done? We have locked in Christina Ricci for this particular story that we're reading today, a script for Suburban Gothic. Just found that out yesterday.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Along with that, we'll be selecting a new director, and we don't have that to announce right now.
Okay, cool. And what was Christina Ricci in most recently?
Saw the recent.
Penelope, Black Snake Moan.
Okay.
Opposite of Sex.
She was the female lead in Black Snake Moan?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And then there's that Speed Racer.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, that's exciting. Super. So, and then this name, Dianton, it's very original, very cute, and it works.
Yeah, our creative department.
A creative department came up with that.
That being Anton.
And we spelled Anton's name correctly and Diane's not. So spell that Dianton for us.
Diane. It is Dianton without the E.
Okay.
Diane Anton.
Right.
Combined.
And then that's, do you guys have a website?
Yes, we do. So that's www.dianton.com.
Okay. And that's Dianton.com. Very cool. And then they can find out more information about what you guys have been up to.
They sure can. It's still under construction, but we've put an area there where they can send us information if they've got a project they're working on us to take a look at. You won't be able to submit a script, but you can put in a log line. And we've got contact information and all, and soon we'll have some of the projects we're working on, so you have an idea of the kinds of things that we're interested in.
Cool. And just to put it in perspective, to do a proper review here of at least of Anton's work, he's been involved with Moby Dick, Cleopatra, Stranded. He's developed scripts from assignment for Disney, Phoenix Pictures, TNT, Showtime, Family, Fox Family, and he's been a script analyst for Warner Brothers, Paramount, 20th Century Fox, Working Titles, and others. For more information about Anton, you can find that out on IMDb, Anton Deether, and what a last name, Diether. So it is exciting to have you guys in studio, because it is neat to see what's happening in and around Austin, but to see a creative, cool thing such as a neat script that has been adapted from some other piece of work, and that's happening right here inside the Austin city limits.
Mm-hmm.
So that is
We're hoping to shoot it here.
Great. So
tax incentive notwithstanding.
Tax incentives. I'm seeing hands flacking. I don't know. Hopefully so. Well, would you? I do want to talk more about adaptation. You want to hit the second scene? Let's hit the second scene.
Sure.
And we'll come back.
Sure. Just very quickly, the second scene is a very short character scene about Julie's character. She's having there's a lot of strange things going on in this house, and she's having a hard time adapting, and she's at a point of weakness. She's also gone cold turkey from prescription drugs, so she's really frazzled, and this is a point where she's about to abandon the children and leave the house because she can't take it anymore.
Mm.
And that's and she's on the phone with her best friend Terry.
Okay, this is excerpt 2 from Suburban Gothic. Interior, Julie's pickup moving, night. Julie burns rubber away from the Holgrave house. She drives through the suburbs toward the freeway, spots a Motel 6 by the on-ramp and pulls into it, parking on the apron. She lights up a cigarette, taking solace in it, grabs her cell phone, dials a number, Terry's filtered phone voice.
Hello?
Terry, it's Julie.
God, Julie, it's the middle of the night.
Sorry. I need to talk to someone. I'm coming unglued.
She gazes at a lit vacancy sign and a veil of cigarette smoke.
fleeing from self.
Yes, you can. You're stronger than you think.
Terry, I dumped my fiancé. Jason dumped me. We're trying to have a baby, but then we found out I was sterile. What was I thinking? Having kids of my own? I can't even babysit. I can't even stop thinking about my little brother Billy. It'll be his day of death soon.
Hey, cut it out. You were just a kid, Julie. There was nothing you could have done about that.
I could have saved him. I couldn't dive. I was too scared to go down. All I could do was watch him drown.
Julie, take it easy, hon. Are you still on your meds?
No. I picked a hell of a time to go cold turkey.
Just stay in control. You want me to come over?
No. Thanks, Tare. I just needed to, I don't know, vent. I'm all right. I gotta go back. My feng shui is out of balance like that house. I gotta fix it.
Okay. Nice. Second excerpt, Julie. And then that's our reader today is Larry Dotson. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Good reading on that regards. Interesting. So we see our protagonists. Basically, what part of the arc would you call this? Or in the, where are we in, if we were looking from beginning to end in this screenplay, and what's happening? If we were looking this from a different perspective, is the character engaging the challenge, or they're at the bottom of the challenge?
She's at the bottom point. She's the ebb of her, you know, when the flaws take over and you have to find a way to control them. You know, she's just basically venting on her friend, but she's going to make the decision to go back and try harder. But there's also a mystery that she has to solve because there are secrets in this house with these children, and she doesn't know what is going on.
Mm-hmm. And so, page 43. That's just right after the first. This is how many pages?
Yeah, it's the beginning of the second act.
Okay, beginning of the second act, mm-hmm. And that's typically what happens. Just to put that in perspective, yeah. A lot of times for our readers, we've got typically 120 pages, give or take, mm-hmm. For a regular three-act structure, and so the second act is the beginning of that the protagonist.
The turning point is usually, you know, when there's some revelation to the character that something is wrong in their life or in their story, in this case, the house, the children that she's babysitting. Okay.
Very interesting. I felt it there. The veil of cigarette smoke. That's pretty interesting. That's pretty. Did you were you smoking at the time? By the way, when you were drinking and waiting for the family
just,
to come back from Russia.
That's a typical Chandler-esque kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
Philip Marlowe kind of thing.
I like it. I like it a lot. What you got there, Dora?
Curiosity question for you. In the script, you give a lot of direction. You know, to do this, go down to the pool, et cetera, et cetera. When you hire the new director, how much leeway does that director have in maybe changing the nuances of the things that you originally, wrote?
Well, yeah, inevitably.
Excellent question.
Yes, there's a lot of changes that the director will make, and when you're writing a script, like stage directions is something you avoid at all costs because then if a director's reading it and if they're interested, you're insulting their own skills. So it's really, you have to keep, you're showing what's there, but you don't try to direct the script.
Maybe another add-on, too, is until you get to where your location is, sometimes it'll change that as well.
Yeah.
Because you've had some scripts that have changed that way, too.
Any number of circumstances could change the whole scene.
Yeah.
So very good advice to people who are writing mm-hmm. scripts for the first time to really be aware of not really being so specific, as you said, to direct, I want you to do this and that. But you suggest it in... Any room also for, because I also got a sense of there were some ways that you wanted the camera to focus or a particular angle to create an effect. Also back off of that a little bit or just give enough of a suggestion?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the only directions in this script are points of view. And because mm-hmm. there's so many subjective points of view that you have to show that because you're trying to, explain to the reader or to the director of the cast that this is from that person's point of view, especially underwater in a pool. You don't have much choice. You have to, who is looking at the... it's not directing. It's just simply setting up the scene.
Okay, and one real last quick comment.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And maybe we'll get to this later. Besides your own work... Okay, recommendations, you know, for some really good scripts that you think do exactly what you're talking about, you know, besides your own. So let's get to that later.
Okay.
And we'll start reading because I want to hear more.
Okay.
Cool. Great questions, Dora. And it's an excellent question because of this whole issue of fine line of direction versus just enough to give the idea is a fine line. So that's wonderful that you mentioned that. You got a thought on that, Nick? No? No?
Not on that.
No, okay, not on that. Okay, very neat. So we've got some time, so we'll go ahead and take off into the third reading there, Anton?
Yes.
Okay, so let's get set up for our third. And this is exciting. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Writing on the Air on KOOP, Hornsby Austin, 91.7 FM, streaming to you live over the internet at koop.org. And in the studio today, we have Mr. Anton Deether, Miss Diane Bernard, Larry Dodson, Miss Dr. Dora Robinson, the one, the myth, the legend, and Dylan McKenzie on the board. Thank you, Dylan. And our mystery guest who shows up without pleasure, Nick Roberts of the Austin Writers Workshop. So we've got a full crowd. It's a full house. Set us up, Mr. Anton, for the excerpt.
This scene is in the third act, and Julie has started to uncover the mystery of what the children's secrets is in regards to the past, the neighbor, Max, who is having an affair with their mother before they both violently died. And she's beginning to piece it together. This, again, is a scene where her best friend, Terry, is coming over. She's landscaping the backyard, and he's coming over to help her. And something startling happens with Sean, which is part of the development of this boy's character, because he's very troubled, and he's also psychokinetic. That's a spoiler, but, you know, given where have short excerpts, you'd have to know that.
We're getting ready to read.
Okay.
So, exterior, backyard, day. Terry enters from his side gate in shorts and tank top and dumps a power saw on the excavated sauna area. Julie hurries over.
God, am I glad to see you.
She throws her arms around him in a huge, desperate hug.
Hey, I still don't swing that way.
Thanks for coming.
What exactly are you going for here? South Seas kitsch?
Sean and Melissa appear in the patio doorway, both stiffen at the sight of the handsome, muscled hunk by their nanny.
Hey, night crawlers. Come out.
They shuffle out, Sean staring intensely at the stranger.
Sean? Melissa? This is Terry.
Hey, Melissa. Hey, Sean.
He steps heartily over to Sean, hand raised for a high five. Sean doesn't move, coursing with tension.
They're a bit shy around strangers.
Melissa dashes back into the house.
Melissa!
Sean darts to edge away. Julie's look stops him.
You stay put. I need my slave.
Same scene later. The power saw buzzes. Terry rips through roots of dried up shrubs. Julie trims hibiscus trees. Sean stands rooted to the spot, his weary eyes fixed on Terry. Julie turns.
Sean, be a sweetie. Bring us a couple of bottled waters.
Sean storms away to the house. Terry steps over to Julie.
You see what I mean?
Raging hormones, that's all. Even I was a basket case at his age.
Terry, I found some explicit home videos. Their mother was screwing the next door neighbor before she died. The kids know about it. Every dirty detail.
Jesus, honey. Stay out of it. You're just the babysitter.
Nanny. I'm responsible for them, Terry. They need me.
Just don't get too involved. Don't go talking to this neighbor.
Max, I can't. He's dead. I think Sean's haunted or possessed by Max's ghost or something. I don't know.
Ghost or something?
You think I'm crazy?
Well, your imagination does tend to get in a hyperactive drive sometimes.
They see Sean emerge from the house. Terry leans into Julie.
You come work for my landscaping company. Quit trying to be Mary Poppins to the Adams family.
Sean approaches with two squirt top water bottles. Terry nods down at a hole with the rusted pipe.
You've got an underground leak here. Let me see what I can do. I'm good with pipe.
Guys, you're all alike, even the flaming ones.
Terry strips off his tank top, kneels down into the muddy hole, and digs around the pipe, fishing for the leak. Julie takes the water bottle from Sam.
Thanks, sweetie. Terry, water?
Terry rises and grabs a bottle. They drink together. Julie glances over Terry's hard body.
Pumping iron at the gym, I see.
Anything to get their attention.
Sean frowns at the flirting body language, his face rigid.
You're so bad.
She jostles Terry, then squirts him with her bottle.
Hey, watch it!
He squirts her back, soaking her top. They chuckle together, Terry throwing an arm around her shoulders.
Don't you touch her!
Julie and Terry stunned. The boy trembles with fury.
Go away! Get away from my house!
Sean, what are you doing?
I don't want him here!
The underground pipe suddenly erupts. Water gushes out of the hole. Julie hurries over and grips the child.
Stop it now!
The saw powers on, jerking spasmatically on the ground, inches from Terry's feet. He jumps out of its way.
Sean, settle down!
She grapples with him. Sean screams over her shoulder.
Go away, you dirty pig!
Julie slaps his face hard. Stung, Sean comes to his senses. He clutches Julie tight, spilling tears.
Please, make him go away! Please!
The pipe flooding stops. Terry kicks off the saw ignition and picks up the dead machine, frowning at the boy.
I'll come back another time.
He leaves by the side gate. Sean weeps pathetically in Julie's arms. She holds him.
Shh, shh, shh. It's okay. It's okay. What's gotten into you?
I wasn't going to hurt him. It just happened. I got scared.
Tears in his eyes. Julie hugs him, trying to understand. You are listening to a reading excerpt from Suburban Gothic. We'll discuss this more as soon as we're right back. Stay tuned.
Support for Co-op comes from Vital Tree Care, a locally owned business offering pruning, root and soil care, and consultation. The goal of Vital Tree Care is to provide an ecologically sound approach to the environment of each yard according to its needs regarding restoration and maintenance of the canopy and the soil. For more information on Vital Tree Care, you may visit vitaltreecareaustin.com.
And you are listening to Writing on the Air on KOOP, Hornsby, Austin, 91.7 FM. Live in studio today, we are doing excerpts from a screenplay. Anton Tiefer, Miss Diane Bernard from Dianton Productions are here with a couple of different writers. Jennifer was here earlier. Larry Dotson is reading in studio. We have the entourage, Mr. Nick, in the studio from Austin Writers Workshop, and Dr. Dora Robinson and Dylan McKenzie on the board. So, we've got a little time, but we have another really juicing climactic final excerpt. Anything at the moment, Dora, that you want to talk about or that we want to hit on the quick third point? Anything of that? That was amazing. It was riptivating. Riptivating. There you go.
You know, actually, I'd like to just get right to the next read. Okay. And then maybe next week, you know, we can get that from you, Antoine. Some recommendations and mention it next week.
Sounds good.
But let's read.
Let's read. So set us up for our... By the way, this is the biggest hook. Set us up.
Well, this is really only the first half of the climax with the cliffhanger. And what a lot of things have transpired, which I don't have time to explain. But the home videos of their dead mother and the neighbor has been Julie has found them, but by accident, one of the children sees them, Melissa, and she goes. She has a total mental meltdown, and the scene begins with Melissa is asleep. She's she's been sedated, and it's just Julie and the boy Sean alone, and the truth starts to come out in the story.
Excerpt 4. Exterior, suburban street, evening. Quiet and deserted, dusk wanes tonight, then to darkness. Interior, master bedroom, night. Melissa is deep asleep, drugged and sedated from her post-traumatic shock. A quiet vigil by her bedside, Julie dozing. Sean watches Julie, deep in troubled thought. Julie startles awake, reacting to Sean's stare.
Sean? Are you all right?
Sean nods pensively. Julie shivers from a chill. She rises to open the bathroom door to the summer night.
Oh, AC's too high. I'll be right back.
Interior living room night. She checks the thermostat. The air conditioning is off. Interior master bedroom night. Julie walks back in and stops dead. Sean stands before the powered-on TV, staring at the paused home video image of Max Stryker, shaking his prosthetic claw hand angrily at camera. At Max's twisted, snarling face, Julie switches it off.
Don't look at that, hon. I'm going to burn these DVDs.
Sean gazes at the dark screen in his own world.
Sean, come here.
She takes him gently and sits him down on the bed with her.
You want to talk about this? You know, about Max?
Sean lowers his eyes, a dark, brooding look.
I mean, if you don't want to, it's...
No, it's okay.
Julie waits. Sean toys with the remote, saying nothing.
You spent a lot of time with Max.
Dad was never around. He tore up Mom's pictures like it was all her fault. Were for Dad, none of this would have ever happened.
None of what would ever have happened? Did your father do something bad to Max?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, because I did.
You?
I killed Max.
Honey, don't say things like that.
I did, last summer.
Sean, you can't mean that.
I didn't hate Max. I really liked him, but he was hurting my mom.
Exterior pool area flashback, night. Nightmarish angles, handheld view, a home video gone mad.
They were fighting again.
The kids scrambled down the treehouse ladder, drawn to a violent quarrel in the lit, churning jacuzzi. Jessica pummels at Max with her fists drunk out of control. Max shoves her underwater with his claw hand.
I thought he was trying to drown her. I had to stop it.
Sean suddenly appears at the jacuzzi, wielding his golf club. He swings it wild, strikes Max hard. Max flails back in anger, but Sean swings again and again. Jessica leaps out of the tub, screaming. Melissa seizes her hand and drags her to the house. Sean, a wild-eyed jumble of rage and terror, gawks at a blood-soaked Max, bewildered eyes on Sean's. Reeling, dazed, and a cauldron of crimson froth, he tries to stagger out. Sean cringes back, Max loses consciousness, and topples over into the pool. Interior, master bedroom, night. Sean's eyes glisten. Julie listens, chilled through.
Mom shut us in our rooms. Then she went back to the pool. Max was dead. I didn't see it, but I know it's true. I saw them afterwards.
Exterior house driveway flashback night. On the rooftop, Sean stares down from the edge at a soaked Jessica, dragging a limp Max to her car, struggling with him. She looks around, then shoves his body into the passenger side. She jumps in and drives off into the night.
She took off with the body. She was all freaked out. I guess that's when the car ran off the road.
Interior master bedroom night. Sean's eyes well up, a soul-wrenching grief.
I never saw her again. She never came back. I didn't mean to do it.
Oh, Sean, it wasn't your fault.
She holds him to her, suddenly remembering something.
Sean, listen to me. Max didn't drown. He was still breathing when they found him in the car crash.
No, I killed him.
You didn't. He was still alive.
No!
Sean jumps up. The bedroom lamp pops out, semi-darkness.
I killed him!
Sean, you've got to believe me. You didn't do anything wrong.
The TV switches itself back on. Max's ranting face. Sean fixes on it, wild-eyed.
Leave me alone. Go away!
Sean, don't do this.
Leave me alone!
He flees out of the bathroom doorway. Exterior pool area night, an electrical nightmare. Every light flashing from a power surge. The jacuzzi churns on. The pool vent bubbles. Sean runs out, reacting to the rippling pool. Julie races after him. Sean starts to dash away, and Julie grabs him.
Sean, wait!
Sean struggles against her.
You didn't kill Max! He was still alive, don't you understand? Your mom found him unconscious. That's why she dragged him to the car. To take him to the hospital, they both died in the crash.
Sean shakes his head, unable to fathom her words.
Sean, you didn't kill anyone.
Yes, I did. And he's coming back for me. He's real.
He's not real if you don't believe in him.
Sean darts his eyes around, his fear spinning out of control.
He's here now. I can feel him.
He bolts for the treehouse ladder. Julie yanks him back.
Sean, don't stay with me.
He's here. He's coming.
He's only real in your mind. There is no ghost. You're doing it all.
Sean shakes his head in denial, staring down into the pool. Julie looks down with him. Diver Freddy undulates on the bottom, a twisted grin on his painted face, Max's face, scowling up at them.
No!
He staggers warily back. Julie holds onto him, persistent.
He's not real. Just will him away.
I can't.
Sean fights to get away. Julie fights to hold onto him. The pool pump powers on. Wall pipes shake with horrific force, an overload of water pressure. Rivets pop out. Delirious, Sean breaks away and snatches up a garden rake. He swings it down against the pool surface, splashing the diver's image away.
Go away, you dirty pig! Go away!
Sean, stop it, please!
Pumped water gushes into the pool, an eruption of swirling bubbles. He bashes the water in a demented rage.
Don't you touch my mom!
A geyser of water shoots skyward out of the pool skimmer, its lid hitting the base of the treehouse. The lid bounces off at a straight angle and grazes Sean's skull. Stunned, unconscious, he slumps over into the pool's deep end.
Sean!
She gapes down in horror. The boy sinks lifelessly to the bottom. It's her drowning brother Billy all over again. Very nice, Diane.
Yeah,
very nice.
Exciting script.
Very nice, Anton.
I mean, the only thing I would have to say is that I think Julie, the babysitter, deserves a raise.
She's a nanny.
Nanny. And one other thing, even I would like to be a member of Anton's 20 or 30 members of his entourage, but I haven't actually been accepted as part of it yet. Maybe someday.
We have a website now. Actually, it's right. It's your entourage.
Yeah, we're part of your entourage. We all know you through you. Well, that's interesting. Right. Interesting. Thoughts?
Just that it's riveting. Particularly, you know, the action as it continues to rise and rise and rise. And it's not even, to me, there's probably still going up more. And yet I'm just, you know, okay, so what's going to happen? So it's exactly what you want, you know, is the suspense, the build up, the suspense. And don't know if there's a twist at the end. Don't know. So,
yeah.
It's really good. It's
difficult
really good.
Choosing the scenes because obviously we're not telling the whole story. We're just giving snippets. But there's a lot more going on, and there is kind of a sixth sense ending that's quite unexpected. So, but it's impossible to. We don't have enough time to explain
it. Well, I don't think you want to give it away either because you don't want to. You know,
don't want to spoil it too much.
Yeah, you know, when folks go to the movie. And stuff.
That's
but
right.
It's really.
Well, thank you.
Very well done.
After that scene, I need a towel. That was very good.
Do you need a towel in general or just after?
Just after that scene.
Now, would you describe your script as a Sixth Sense type film? Or what would be the? How would you describe
it? It's kind of in that category of The Orphanage, Sixth Sense, those kind of films. But it's more of a psychological thriller. I'm trying to go for the old Hitchcock school, which is to suggest terror rather than show it graphically as they do with torture porn and a lot of the silly horror movies that they make.
I just think the other thing is that the boy is very believable. Because I worked with kids that have emotional and behavioral problems. And what you've done is that, you know, he's very real. It's very plausible because of what kids do in their head and then don't talk to anybody.
Yeah. Well, like in that third scene with Terry and the power saw, he's transferring the image of Max, who is also a very, you know, hunky, handsome-looking guy. And he's visualizing his mother with Max again, even though it's just his nanny with her best friend. So he has a lot.
He has a lot.
A lot of demons in his psyche.
So bring us up to date again as we kind of come to the close here. Where are you at in terms of, do you have someone who's going to produce this?
Yeah. Well, actually, we are going to be producing
this. Okay, you're going to be producing it.
Today.
And
we'll
have your
executive producers now.
Yeah. How are you coming along in terms of staffing everything?
Well, all that's going to be handled with our line producer, and you know, we've got a director, so they'll be choosing a lot, making some decisions all together. But all that's coming into place because, as you know, the most important part is getting your actors, your director, and your financing, and that's where we're at. So,
do you have a production date, start date yet, or
not
quite
official,
there yet?
We've just been told we're being given her in the fall.
Okay, all right. Been a delight having you here.
What a gift, you know.
Thank you. I'll tell you, it's a joy working with Anton. I feel really lucky to be his partner, and we're really looking forward to seeing what we can produce here out of Austin.
Well, that's mutual.
For sure.
I mean, most writers' dreams are to try to produce their own scripts because they can have creative control. Mm-hmm. That's the main reason why I formed the company with Diane, and she's making it happen for me. So that's a big plus for me as a writer.
Mm-hmm. And I get to read all of his scripts, so it's great for me.
Oh, even the bad ones.
No, they're all good. He's critical.
This is wonderful. But I would like to, just to put it in perspective, we often talk about revisions and editing, and so this is something that's basically polished, super, super polished, past polish point. How many revisions or how many rewrites do you think this is required?
Probably a dozen.
Probably a dozen. Now, yeah. And put it in that perspective, now that's complete, maybe overhauls, complete rewrites. How many table reads do you think that this script's been through?
Oh, table reads?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably three or four.
Three or four complete reads, and then you've incorporated their suggestions and feedback and tightening and adjusting. You
know, it's this, of course, the studio readers and producers that who read it in the past, are, mm-hmm. you know, I have to take them a lot more seriously than table reads from my friends because they're the buyers. But mm-hmm. unfortunately, now we're no longer the buyers. We're making the picture ourselves.
So exciting.
I don't have to answer to them.
Right.
I'm very happy about that.
So exciting. Now, just to put it in perspective, and Dylan hit on an excellent question, if we were to look at like a calendar year or look from beginning to end, you guys are possibly in the first, if you were looking at the planning and the pre-production phase, I mean, you're obviously in that. You've not gone into production. And wouldn't you say the vast majority of your time on a film should be spent in the pre-production planning, pre-production, so that the production is actually a short amount of time, possibly, and it might be 6 weeks or shorter than that. And then you've got
the whole process takes about a year.
So really?
If we started in fall of 2010, mm-hmm. we'd be finished in 2011. It probably wouldn't be a release date until 2013. That's usually the way it is.
Really? But what is this stage? And this is pre-production, I guess. So if you're saying the whole process takes a year,
pre-production will be next year.
Okay, but what is this stage?
You know, putting the deal together.
Okay, so you're putting the deal.
I would say it takes the longest to do the deal because there's so many parts that can break down, and everybody has requirements. I mean, starting from the writer mm-hmm. all the way to the director, and making sure everybody likes each other. It's a really complex process. So a writer's got to be really patient, and the more flexible they are, the better opportunities there are for them to get their materials produced.
I may be way off base here. This is not my field, but I'm just curious. At this stage, do you do anything in terms of, you say the film would be released, 3 years from now, if it's finally done. Do you do anything now about, the releasing company or who's gonna take that film to wherever you're going
to
have it go?
Or does that come? Distribution in advance.
Okay. Okay.
That was acquired distribution or quiet?
Acquired.
Okay.
Yes. You have to nail the distribution pretty early on before you can go into production.
Really?
Yeah.
Aren't taking the gamble. You're not taking the gamble.
Well, there's independent productions that will take their chances with the film festivals, but,
But you're not independent?
No, we're a mini studio.
You're a mini? Okay.
We want to be anyway.
Exactly. So there's some fine lines. We're going to definitely have to have you come back on and talk more about that process. It's been great. Thank you, Anton, very much. Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Larry,
we appreciate you
pleasure.
Having us on your show.
Dora, great thoughts, great comments. It's been a pleasure as always. It's very good. See you next time.
Next time.
Dylan, thank you so much. Nick, thanks for coming on. It's good to see you. Cheers. We take great pleasure in having you listen with us and having such a great performance as this. Thanks. Until next time, cheers, take care, and good night.
Thank you for listening to another broadcast day at KOOP Hornsby Austin 91.7 FM, Community Radio.